In her loneliness, she turned to her husband for reassurance, entertainment, for things to fill the vacant places. Housework was not enough. There were only two rooms and no yard to keep or move about in. The women in the town wore high-heeled shoes, and when Pauline tried to wear them, they aggravated her shuffle into a pronounced limp. Charlie was kindness still, but began to resist her total dependence on him. They were beginning to have less and less to say to each other. He had no problem finding other people and other things to occupy him. Men were always climbing the stairs asking for him, and he was happy to accompany them, leaving her alone. Pauline felt uncomfortable with the few black women she met. They were amused by her because she did not straighten her hair. When she tried to make up her face as they did, it came off rather badly. Their goading glances and private snickers at her way of talking, saying children, and dressing developed in her a desire for new clothes. When Charlie began to quarrel about the money she wanted, she decided to go to work. Taking jobs as a day worker helped with clothes and even a few things for the apartment, but it did not help with Charlie. He was not pleased with her purchases and began to tell her so. Their marriage was shredded with quarrels. She was still no more than a girl and still waiting for that plateau of happiness, that hand of a precious lord who, when her way grew drear, would always linger near. Only now she had a clearer idea of what drear meant. Money became the focus of all their discussions, hers for clothes, his for drink. The sad thing was that Pauline did not really care for clothes and makeup. She merely wanted other women to cast favorable glances her way. After several months of doing day work, she took a steady job in the home of a family of slender means and nervous, pretentious ways. Charlie commenced to get meaner and meaner and wanted to fight me all the time. I gave him as good as I got, had to. Looked like working for that woman and fighting Charlie was all I did, tiresome. But I held on to my jobs, even though working for that woman was more than a notion. It wasn't so much her meanness as just simple-minded. Her whole family was. Couldn't get along with one another worth nothing. You'd think with a pretty house like that and all the money they could hold on to, they would enjoy one another. She'd haul off and cry over the leastest thing. If one of her friends cut her short on the telephone, she'd go to crying. She should have been glad she had a telephone. I ain't got one yet. I recollect once how her baby brother, who she put through dentistry school, didn't invite them to some big party he throwed. There was a big to-do about that. Everybody stayed on the telephone for days, fussing and carrying on. She asked me, "Pauline, what would you do if your own brother had a party and didn't invite you?" I said, "If I really wanted to go to that party, I reckon I'd go anyhow, never mind what he want." She just sucked her teeth a little and made out like what I said was dumb. All the while, I was thinking how dumb she was. Whoever told her that her brother was her friend? Folks can't like folks just 'cause they has the same mama. I tried to like that woman myself. She was good about giving me stuff, but I just couldn't like her. Soon as I worked up a good feeling on her account, she'd do something ignorant, start into telling me how to clean and do. If I left her on her own, she'd drown in dirt. I didn't have to pick up after chicken and pie the way I had to pick up after them. None of them knew so much as how to wipe their behinds. I know, 'cause I did the washing, and couldn't pee proper to save their lives. Her husband ain't hit the bowl yet. Nasty white folks is about the nastiest things they is. But I would have stayed on, excepting for Charlie come over by where I was working and cut up so. He come there drunk, wanting some money. When that white woman see him, she turned red. She tried to act strong-like, but she was scared bad. Anyway, she told Charlie to get out or she would call the police. He cussed her and started pulling on me. I would have gone upside his head, but I don't want no dealings with the police. So I'd taken my things and left. I tried to get back, but she didn't want me no more if I was going to stay with Charlie. She said she would let me stay if I left him. I thought about that. But later on, it didn't seem none too bright for a black woman to leave a black man for a white woman. She didn't ever give me the $11 she owed me, neither. That hurt bad. The gas man had cut the gas off, and I couldn't cook none. I really begged that woman for my money. I went to see her. She was mad as a wet hen. Kept on telling me I owed her for uniforms and some old broken-down bed she'd give me. I don't know if I owed her or not, but I needed my money. She wouldn't let up none, neither, even when I give her my word that Charlie wouldn't come back there no more. Then I got so desperate, I asked her if she would loan it to me. She was quiet for a spell, and then she told me I shouldn't let a man take advantage over me, that I should have more respect, and it was my husband's duty to pay the bills, and if he couldn't, I should leave him and get alimony. All such simple stuff. What was he gonna give me alimony on? I seen she didn't understand that all I needed from her was my $11 to pay the gas man so I could cook. She couldn't get that one thing through her thick head. Are you going to leave him, Pauline? She kept on saying. I thought she'd give me my money if I said I would. So I said, yes, ma'am. All right, she said. You leave him and then come back to work, and we'll let bygones be bygones. Can I have my money today? I said. No, she said. Only when you leave him. I'm only thinking of you and your future. What good is he, Pauline? What good is he to you? How are you going to answer a woman like that, who don't know what good a man is, and say out of one side of her mouth she's thinking of your future, but won't give you your own money so you could buy you something besides bologna to eat? So I said, no good, ma'am. He ain't no good to me. But just the same, I think I'd best stay on. She got up, and I left. When I got outside, I felt pains in my crotch. I had held my legs together so tight, trying to make that woman understand. But I reckon now she couldn't understand. She married a man with a slash in his face instead of a mouth. So how could she understand? One winter, Pauline discovered she was pregnant. When she told Charlie, he surprised her by being pleased. He began to drink less and come home more often. They eased back into a relationship more like the early days of their marriage, when he asked if she were tired or wanted him to bring her something from the store. In this state of ease, Pauline stopped doing day work and returned to her own housekeeping. But the loneliness in those two rooms had not gone away. When the winter sun hit the peeling green paint of the kitchen chairs, when the smoked hocks were boiling in the pot, when all she could hear was the truck delivering furniture downstairs, she thought about back home, about how she had been all alone most of the time then too, but that this lonesomeness was different. Then she stopped staring at the green chairs, at the delivery truck. She went to the movies instead. There in the dark, her memory was refreshed, and she succumbed to her earlier dreams. Along with the idea of romantic love, she was introduced to another, physical beauty, probably the most destructive ideas in the history of human thought. Both originated in envy, thrived in insecurity, and ended in disillusion. In equating physical beauty with virtue, she stripped her mind, bound it, and collected self-contempt by the heap. She forgot lust and simple caring for. She regarded love as possessive mating and romance as the goal of the spirit. It would be for her a wellspring from which she would draw the most destructive emotions, deceiving the lover and seeking to imprison the beloved, curtailing freedom in every way. She was never able, after her education in the movies, to look at a face and not assign it some category in the scale of absolute beauty, and the scale was one she absorbed in full from the silver screen. There at last were the darkened woods, the lonely roads, the river banks, the gentle, knowing eyes. There the flawed became whole, the blind sighted, and the lame and halt threw away their crutches. There death was dead, and people made every gesture in a cloud of music. There the black and white images came together, making a magnificent whole, all projected through the ray of light from above and behind. It was really a simple pleasure, but she learned all there was to love and all there was to hate. The onliest time I'd be happy seemed like was when I was in the picture show. Every time I got, I went. I'd go early, before the show started. They'd cut off the lights and everything be black. Then the screen would light up, and I'd move right on in them pictures. White men taking such good care of their women, and they all dressed up in big, clean houses, with the bathtubs right in the same room with the toilet. Them pictures gave me a lot of pleasure. But it made coming home hard, and looking at Charlie hard. I don't know. I remember one time I went to see Clark Gable and Jean Harlow. I fixed my hair up like I'd seen hers on a magazine, a part on the side with one little curl on my forehead. It looked just like her. Well, almost just like. Anyway, I sat in that show with my hair done up that way and had a good time. I thought I'd see it through to the end again. And I got up to get me some candy. I was sitting back in my seat, and I'd taken a big bite of that candy, and it pulled a tooth right out of my mouth. I could have cried. I had good teeth, not a rotten one in my head. I don't believe I ever did get over that. There I was, 5 months pregnant, trying to look like Jean Harlow, and a front tooth gone. Everything went then. Looked like I just didn't care no more after that. I let my hair go back, plaited it up, and settled down to just being ugly. I still went to the pictures, though, but the meanness got worse. I wanted my tooth back. Charlie poked fun at me, and we started fighting again. I tried to kill him. He didn't hit me too hard because I were pregnant, I guess. But the fights, once they got started up again, kept up. He began to make me madder than anything I knowed, and I couldn't keep my hands off him. Well, I had that baby, a boy, and after that got pregnant again with another one. But it weren't like I thought it was gonna be. I loved him and all, I guess. But maybe it was having no money, or maybe it was Charlie. But they sure worried the life out of me. Sometimes I'd catch myself hollering at them and beating them, and I'd feel sorry for them, but I couldn't seem to stop. When I had the second one, a girl, I remember I said I'd love it no matter what it looked like. She looked like a black ball of hair. I don't recollect trying to get pregnant that first time, but that second time, I actually tried to get pregnant. Maybe because I'd had one already, and wasn't scared to do it. Anyway, I felt good and wasn't thinking on the carrying, just the baby itself. I used to talk to it whilst it be still in the womb, like good friends we was, you know. I'd be hanging wash, and I knowed lifting weren't good for it. I'd say to it, hold on now, I gonna hang up these few rags, don't get froggy, it'd be over soon. It wouldn't leap for nothing. Or I'd be mixing something in a bowl for the other child, and I'd talk to it then too. You know, just friendly talk. On up till the end. I felt good about that baby. I went to the hospital when my time come, so I could be easeful. I didn't want to have it at home, like I done with the boy. They put me in a big room with a whole mess of women. The pains was coming, but not too bad. A little old doctor come to examine me. He had all sorts of stuff. He gloved his hand and put some kind of jelly on it and rammed it up between my legs. When he left off, some more doctors come. One old one and some young ones. The old one was learning the young ones about babies, showing them how to do. When he got to me, he said, now, these here women you don't have any trouble with. They deliver right away and with no pain, just like horses. The young one smiled a little. They looked at my stomach and between my legs. They never said nothing to me. Only one looked at me, looked at my face, I mean. I looked right back at him. He dropped his eyes and turned red. He knowed, I reckon, that maybe I weren't no horse foaling. But them others, they didn't know. They went on. I seed them talking to them white women. How you feel? Gonna have twins? Just shucking them, of course. But nice talk. Nice, friendly talk. I got edgy. And when them pains got harder, I was glad. Glad to have something else to think about. I moaned something awful. The pains wasn't as bad as I let on, but I had to let them people know having a baby was more than a bowel movement. I hurt, just like them white women. Just 'cause I wasn't hooping and hollering before didn't mean I wasn't feeling pain. What'd they think? That just 'cause I knowed how to have a baby with no fuss, that my behind wasn't pulling and aching like theirs? Besides, that doctor didn't know what he was talking about. He must never seed no mare foal. Who say they don't have no pain? Just 'cause she don't cry? 'Cause she can't say it? They think it ain't there? If they looks in her eyes and see them eyeballs lolling back, see the sorrowful look, they'd know. Anyways, the baby come. Big old healthy thing. She looked different from what I thought. Reckon I talked to it so much before, I conjured up a mind's eye view of it. So when I seed it, it was like looking at a picture of your mama when she was a girl. You knows who she is, but she don't look the same. They give her to me for a nursing, and she liked to pull my nipple off right away. She caught on fast, not like Sammy. He was the hardest child to feed. But Picola looked like she knowed right off what to do. A right smart baby she was. I used to like to watch her. You know, they makes them greedy sounds, eyes all soft and wet, a cross between a puppy and a dying man. But I knowed she was ugly. Head full of pretty hair. But Lord, she was ugly. When Sammy and Picola were still young, Pauline had to go back to work. She was older now, with no time for dreams and movies. It was time to put all the pieces together, make coherence where before there had been none. The children gave her this need. She herself was no longer a child. So she became, and her process of becoming was like most of ours. She developed a hatred for things that mystified or obstructed her. acquired virtues that were easy to maintain, assigned herself a role in the scheme of things, and harked back to simpler times for gratification. She took on the full responsibility and recognition of breadwinner and returned to church. First, however, she moved out of the two rooms into a spacious first floor of a building that had been built as a store. She came into her own with the women who had despised her by being more moral than they. She avenged herself on Charlie by forcing him to indulge in the weaknesses she despised. She joined a church where shouting was frowned upon, served on stewardess board number 3, and became a member of ladies' circle number 1. At prayer meeting, she moaned and sighed over Charlie's ways and hoped God would help her keep the children from the sins of the father. She stopped saying children and said children instead. She let another tooth fall and was outraged by painted ladies who thought only of clothes and men. Holding Charlie as a model of sin and failure, she bore him like a crown of thorns and her children like a cross. It was her good fortune to find a permanent job in the home of a well-to-do family whose members were affectionate, appreciative, and generous. She looked at their houses, smelt their linen, touched their silk draperies, and loved all of it. The child's pink nightie, the stacks of white pillow slips edged with embroidery, the sheets with top hems picked out with blue cornflowers. She became what is known as an ideal servant, for such a role filled practically all of her needs. When she bathed the little Fisher girl, it was in a porcelain tub with silvery taps running infinite quantities of hot, clear water. She dried her in fluffy white towels and put her in cuddly nightclothes. Then she brushed the yellow hair, enjoying the roll and slip of it between her fingers. No zinc tub, no buckets of stove-heated water, no flaky, stiff, grayish towels washed in a kitchen sink, dried in a dusty backyard. No tangled black puffs of rough wool to comb. Soon she stopped trying to keep her own house. The things she could afford to buy didn't last, had no beauty or style, and were absorbed by the dingy storefront. More and more, she neglected her house, her children, her man. They were like the afterthoughts one has just before sleep, the early morning and late evening edges of her day, the dark edges that made the daily life with the Fishers lighter, more delicate, more lovely. Here she could arrange things, clean things, line things up in neat rows. Here her foot flopped around on deep pile carpets, and there was no uneven sound. Here she found beauty, order, cleanliness, and praise. Mr. Fisher said, "I would rather sell her blueberry cobblers than real estate." She reigned over cupboards stacked high with food that would not be eaten for weeks, even months. She was queen of canned vegetables, bought by the case, special fondants, and ribbon candy curled up in tiny silver dishes. The creditors and service people who humiliated her when she went to them on her own behalf respected her, were even intimidated by her when she spoke for the Fishers. She refused beef slightly dark or with edges not properly trimmed. The slightly reeking fish that she accepted for her own family, she would all but throw in the fishman's face if he sent it to the Fisher house. Power, praise, and luxury were hers in this household. They even gave her what she had never had, a nickname, Polly. It was her pleasure to stand in her kitchen at the end of a day and survey her handiwork, knowing there were soap bars by the dozen, bacon by the rasher, and reveling in her shiny pots and pans and polished floors, hearing, "We'll never let her go. We could never find anybody like Polly. She will not leave the kitchen until everything is in order. Really, she is the ideal servant." Pauline kept this order, this beauty for herself, a private world, and never introduced it into her storefront or to her children. Them, she bent toward respectability, and in so doing taught them fear. Fear of being clumsy, fear of being like their father, fear of not being loved by God, fear of madness like Charlie's mother. Into her son she beat a loud desire to run away, and into her daughter she beat a fear of growing up, fear of other people, fear of life. All the meaningfulness of her life was in her work, for her virtues were intact. She was an active churchwoman, did not drink, smoke, or carouse, defended herself mightily against Charlie, rose above him in every way, and felt she was fulfilling a mother's role conscientiously when she pointed out their father's faults to keep them from having them, or punished them when they showed any slovenliness, no matter how slight, when she worked 12 to 16 hours a day to support them. And the world itself agreed with her. It was only sometimes, and then rarely, that she thought about the old days or what her life had turned to. They were musings, idle thoughts, full sometimes of the old dreaminess, but not the kind of thing she cared to dwell on. I started to leave him once, but something came up. Once, after he tried to set the house on fire, I was all set in my mind to go. I can't even remember now what held me. He sure ain't give me much of a life, but it wasn't all bad. Sometimes things wasn't all bad. He used to come easing into bed sometimes, not too drunk. I make out like I'm asleep because it's late, and he'd taken $3 out of my pocketbook that morning or something. I hear him breathing, but I don't look around. I can see in my mind's eye his black arms thrown back behind his head, the muscles like great big peach stones sanded down, with veins running like little swollen rivers down his arms. Without touching him, I'd be feeling those ridges on the tips of my fingers. I seize the palms of his hands, calloused to granite, and the long fingers curled up and still. I think about the thick, knotty hair on his chest and the two big swells his breast muscles make. I want to rub my face hard in his chest and feel the hair cut my skin. I know just where the hair growth slacks out, just above his navel, and how it picks up again and spreads out. Maybe he'll shift a little, and his leg will touch me, or I feel his flank just graze my behind. I don't move, even yet. Then he lifts his head, turn over, and put his hand on my waist. If I don't move, he'll move his hand over to pull and knead my stomach, soft and slow-like. I still don't move because I don't want him to stop. I want to pretend sleep and have him keep on rubbing my stomach. Then he will lean his head down and bite my tit. Then I don't want him to rub my stomach anymore. I want him to put his hand between my legs. I pretend to wake up and turn to him, but not opening my legs. I want him to open them for me. He does, and I be soft and wet where his fingers are strong and hard. I be softer than I ever been before. All my strength in his hand. My brain curls up like wilted leaves. A funny, empty feeling is in my hands. I want to grab hold of something, so I hold his head. His mouth is under my chin. Then I don't want his hand between my legs no more, because I think I am softening away. I stretch my legs open, and he is on top of me, too heavy to hold, and too light not to. He puts his thing in me, in me, in me. I wrap my feet around his back so he can't get away. His face is next to mine. The bid spring sounds like them crickets used to back home. He puts his fingers in mine, and we stretches our arms out wise, like Jesus on the cross. I hold on tight. My fingers and my feet hold on tight, because everything else is going, going. I know he wants me to come first, but I can't. Not until he does. Not until I feel him loving me, just me, sinking into me. Not until I know that my flesh is all that be on his mind, that he couldn't stop if he had to, that he would die rather than take his thing out of me, of me. Not until he has let go of all he has and give it to me, to me, to me. When he does, I feel a power. I be strong. I be pretty. I be young. And then I wait. He shivers and tosses his head. Now I be strong enough, pretty enough, and young enough to let him make me come. I take my fingers out of his and put my hands on his behind. My legs drop back onto the bed. I don't make no noise, because the children might hear. I begin to feel those little bits of color floating up into me, deep in me, that streak of green from the June bug light, the purple from the berries trickling along my thighs. Mama's lemonade yellow runs sweet in me. Then I feel like I'm laughing between my legs, and the laughing gets all mixed up with the colors, and I'm afraid I'll come, and afraid I won't, but I know I will, and I do, and it be rainbow all inside, and it lasts, and lasts, and lasts. I want to thank him, but don't know how, so I pat him like you do a baby. He asks me if I'm all right. I say yes. He gets off me and lies down to sleep. I want to say something, but I don't. I don't want to take my mind off of the rainbow. I should get up and go to the toilet, but I don't. Besides, Charlie is asleep with his leg thrown over me. I can't move and don't want to. But it ain't like that anymore. Most times he's thrashing away inside me before I'm woke and through when I am. The rest of the time I can't even be next to stinking drunk self. But I don't care about it no more. My maker will take care of me. I know he will. I know he will. Besides, it don't make no difference about this old earth. There is sure to be a glory. Only thing I miss sometimes is that rainbow. But like I say, I don't recollect it much anymore. See, Father, he is big and strong. Father, will you play with Jane? Father is smiling. Smile, Father. Smile. Smile. When Charlie was 4 days old, his mother wrapped him in 2 blankets and 1 newspaper and placed him on a junk heap by the railroad. His great-aunt Jimmy, who had seen her niece carrying a bundle out the back door, rescued him. She beat his mother with a razor strap and wouldn't let her near the baby after that. Aunt Jimmy raised Charlie herself, but took delight sometimes in telling him of how she had saved him. He gathered from her that his mother wasn't right in the head, but he never had a chance to find out, because she ran away shortly after the razor strap, and no one had heard of her since. Charlie was grateful for having been saved, except sometimes. Sometimes when he watched Aunt Jimmy eating collards with her fingers, sucking her four gold teeth, or smelled her when she wore the asfetida bag around her neck, or when she made him sleep with her for warmth in the winter, and he could see her old, wrinkled breasts sagging in her nightgown. Then he wondered whether it would have been just as well to have died there, down in the rim of a tire, under a soft, black Georgia sky. He had 4 years of school before he got courage enough to ask his aunt who and where his father was. "That Fuller boy, I believe it was," his aunt said. "He was hanging around then, but he'd taken off pretty quick before you was born. I think he'd gone to Macon, him or his brother, maybe both. I hear old man Fuller say something about it once." "What name he have?" asked Charlie.
"Fuller, foolish.
I mean, what his given name?" "Oh." She closed her eyes to think and sighed. "Can't recollect nothing no more. Sam, was it?"
"Yeah, Samuel."
No, it wasn't. It was Samson. Samson Fuller. "How come you all didn't name me Samson?" Charlie's voice was low.
"What for? He wasn't nowhere around when you was born. Your mama didn't name you nothing. The 9 days wasn't up before she throwed you on the junk heap. When I got you, I named you myself on the 9th day. You named after my dead brother, Charles Breedlove, a good man. Ain't no Samson never come to no good end."
Charlie didn't ask anything else. 2 years later, he quit school to take a job at Tyson's Feed and Grain Store. He swept up, ran errands, weighed bags, and lifted them onto the drays. Sometimes they let him ride with the drayman, a nice old man called Blue Jack. Blue used to tell him old-timey stories about how it was when the Emancipation Proclamation came, how the black people hollered, cried, and sang, and ghost stories about how a white man cut off his wife's head and buried her in the swamp, and the headless body came out at night and went stumbling around the yard, knocking over stuff because it couldn't see, and crying all the time for a comb. They talked about the women Blue had had, and the fights he'd been in when he was younger, about how he talked his way out of getting lynched once, and how others hadn't. Charlie loved Blue. Long after he was a man, he remembered the good times they had had. How on a July 4th, at a church picnic, a family was about to break open a watermelon. Several children were standing around watching. Blue was hovering about on the periphery of the circle, a faint smile of anticipation softening his face. The father of the family lifted the melon high over his head. His big arms looked taller than the trees to Charlie, and the melon blotted out the sun. Tall, head forward, eyes fastened on a rock, his arms higher than the pines, his hands holding a melon bigger than the sun, he paused an instant to get his bearing and secure his aim. Watching the figure etched against the bright blue sky, Charlie felt goose pimples popping along his arms and neck.
He wondered if God looked like that. No, God was a nice old white man with long white hair, flowing white beard, and little blue eyes that looked sad when people died and mean when they were bad. It must be the devil who looks like that, holding the world in his hands, ready to dash it to the ground and spill the red guts so niggers could eat the sweet, warm insides. If the devil did look like that, Charlie preferred him. He never felt anything, thinking about God, but just the idea of the devil excited him. And now the strong black devil was blotting out the sun and getting ready to split open the world. Far away, somebody was playing a mouth organ. The music slithered over the cane fields and into the pine grove. It spiraled around the tree trunks and mixed itself with the pine scent, so Charlie couldn't tell the difference between the sound and the odor that hung about the heads of the people. The man swung the melon down to the edge of a rock. A soft cry of disappointment accompanied the sound of smashed rind. The break was a bad one. The melon was jagged, and hunks of rind and red meat scattered on the grass. Blue jumped. "Oh," he moaned, "there go the heart." His voice was both sad and pleased. Everybody looked to see the big red chunk from the very center of the melon, free of rind and sparse of seed, which had rolled a little distance from Blue's feet. He stooped to pick it up. Blood red, its planes dull and blunted with sweetness, its edges rigid with juice, too obvious, almost obscene, in the joy it promised. "Go ahead, Blue," the father laughed. "You can have it." Blue smiled and walked away. Little children scrambled for the pieces on the ground. Women picked out the seeds for the smallest ones and broke off little bits of the meat for themselves. Blue's eye caught Charlie's. He motioned to him. "Come on, boy. Let's you and me eat the heart." Together, the old man and the boy sat on the grass and shared the heart of the watermelon, the nasty sweet guts of the earth. It was in the spring, a very chilly spring, that Aunt Jimmy died of peach cobbler. She went to a camp meeting that took place after a rainstorm, and the damp wood of the benches was bad for her. For 4 or 5 days afterward, she felt poorly. Friends came to see about her. Some made chamomile tea, others rubbed her with liniment. Miss Alice, her closest friend, read the Bible to her. Still, she was declining. Advice was prolific, if contradictory. "Don't eat no whites of eggs. Drink new milk. Chew on this root." Aunt Jimmy ignored all but Miss Alice's Bible reading. She nodded in drowsy appreciation as the words from 1 Corinthians droned over her. Sweet amens fell from her lips as she was chastised for all her sins, but her body would not respond. Finally, it was decided to fetch Madeer. Madeer was a quiet woman who lived in a shack near the woods. She was a competent midwife and decisive diagnostician. Few could remember when Madeer was not around. In any illness that could not be handled by ordinary means, known cures, intuition, or endurance, the word was always, "Fetch Madeer." When she arrived at Aunt Jimmy's house, Charlie was amazed at the sight of her. He had always pictured her as shriveled and hunched over, for he knew she was very, very old. But Madeer loomed taller than the preacher who accompanied her. She must have been over 6 feet tall.
four big white knots of hair gave power and authority to her soft black face. Standing straight as a poker, she seemed to need her hickory stick not for support, but for communication. She tapped it lightly on the floor as she looked down at Aunt Jemmy's wrinkled face. She stroked the knob with the thumb of her right hand while she ran her left one over Aunt Jemmy's body. The backs of her long fingers she placed on the patient's cheek, then placed her palm on the forehead. She ran her fingers through the sick woman's hair, lightly scratching the scalp and then looking at what the fingernails revealed. She lifted Aunt Jemmy's hand and looked closely at it. Fingernails, back skin, the flesh of the palm she pressed with three fingertips. Later she put her ear on Aunt Jemmy's chest and stomach to listen. At Medea's request, the woman pulled the slop jar from under the bed to show the stools. Medea tapped her stick while looking at them. "Bury the slop jar and everything in it," she said to the women. To Aunt Jemmy, she said, "You done caught cold in your womb. Drink pot liquor and nothing else." "Will it pass?" asked Aunt Jemmy. "Is I'm gonna be all right?" "I reckon." Medea turned and left the room. The preacher put her in his buggy to take her home. That evening, the women brought bowls of pot liquor from black-eyed peas, from mustards, from cabbage, from kale, from collards, from turnips, from beets, from green beans, even the juice from a boiling hog jowl. 2 evenings later, Aunt Jemmy had gained much strength. When Miss Alice and Mrs. Gaines stopped in to check on her, they remarked on her improvement. The three women sat talking about various miseries they had had, their cure or abatement, and what it helped. Over and over again, they returned to Aunt Jemmy's condition, repeating its cause, what could have been done to prevent the misery from taking hold, and Medea's infallibility. Their voices blended into a trinity of nostalgia about pain. Rising and falling, complex in harmony, uncertain in pitch, but constant in the recitative of pain. They hugged the memories of illnesses to their bosoms. They licked their lips and clucked their tongues in fond remembrance of pains they had endured. Childbirth, rheumatism, croup, sprains, backaches, piles. All of the bruises they had collected from moving about the earth, harvesting, cleaning, hoisting, pitching, stooping, kneeling, picking. Always with young ones underfoot. But they had been young once. The odor of their armpits and haunches had mingled into a lovely musk. Their eyes had been furtive, their lips relaxed, and the delicate turn of their heads on those slim black necks had been like nothing other than a doze. Their laughter had been more touch than sound. Then they had grown, edging into life from the back door, becoming. Everybody in the world was in a position to give them orders. White women said, "Do this." White children said, "Give me that." White men said, "Come here." Black men said, "Lay down." The only people they need not take orders from were black children and each other. But they took all of that and recreated it in their own image. They ran the houses of white people and knew it. When white men beat their men, they cleaned up the blood and went home to receive abuse from the victim. They beat their children with one hand and stole for them with the other. The hands that fell trees also cut umbilical cords. The hands that wrung the necks of chickens and butchered hogs
also nudged African violets into bloom. The arms that loaded sheaves, bales, and sacks rocked babies into sleep. They patted biscuits into flaky ovals of innocence and shrouded the dead. They plowed all day and came home to nestle like plums under the limbs of their men. The legs that straddled a mule's back were the same ones that straddled their men's hips, and the difference was all the difference there was. Then they were old, their bodies honed, their odor sour, squatting in a cane field, stooping in a cotton field, kneeling by a riverbank. They had carried a world on their heads. They had given over the lives of their own children and tendered their grandchildren. With relief, they wrapped their heads in rags and their breasts in flannel, eased their feet into felt. They were through with lust and lactation, beyond tears and terror. They alone could walk the roads of Mississippi, the lanes of Georgia, the fields of Alabama, unmolested. They were old enough to be irritable when and where they chose, tired enough to look forward to death, disinterested enough to accept the idea of pain while ignoring the presence of pain. They were, in fact, and at last, free. And the lives of these old black women were synthesized in their eyes, a puree of tragedy and humor, wickedness and serenity, truth and fantasy. They chattered far into the night. Charlie listened and grew sleepy. The lullaby of grief enveloped him, rocked him, and at last numbed him. In his sleep, the foul odor of an old woman's stools turned into the healthy smell of horse shit, and the voices of the three women were muted into the pleasant notes of a mouth organ. He was aware, in his sleep, of being curled up in a chair, his hands tucked between his thighs. In a dream, his penis changed into a long hickory stick, and the hands caressing it were the hands of Madeir. On a wet Saturday night, before Aunt Jimmy felt strong enough to get out of bed, Essie Foster brought her a peach cobbler. The old lady ate a piece, and the next morning, when Charlie went to empty the slop jar, she was dead. Her mouth was a slackened O, and her hands, those long fingers with a man's hard nails, having done their laying by, could now be dainty on the sheet. One open eye looked at him, as if to say, "Mind how you take hold of that jar, boy." Charlie stared back, unable to move, until a fly settled at the corner of her mouth. He fanned it away angrily, looked back at the eye, and did its bidding. Aunt Jimmy's funeral was the first Charlie had ever attended. As a member of the family, one of the bereaved, he was the object of a great deal of attention. The ladies had cleaned the house, aired everything out, notified everybody, and stitched together what looked like a white wedding dress for Aunt Jimmy, a maiden lady to wear when she met Jesus. They even produced a dark suit, white shirt, and tie for Charlie. The husband of one of them cut his hair. He was enclosed in fastidious tenderness. Nobody talked to him, that is. They treated him like the child he was, never engaging him in serious conversation. But they anticipated wishes he never had. Meals appeared, hot water for the wooden tub, clothes laid out. At the wake, he was allowed to fall asleep, and arms carried him to bed. Only on the third day after the death, the day of the funeral, did he have to share the spotlight. Aunt Jimmy's people came from
nearby towns and farms, her brother, O.V., his children and wife and lots of cousins. But Charlie was still the major figure, because he was Jimmy's boy, the last thing she loved, and the one who found her. The solicitude of the women, the head pats of the men, pleased Charlie, and the creamy conversations fascinated him. What'd she die from?
Essie's pie.
Don't say. Uh-huh. She was doing fine. I saw her the very day before. Said she wanted me to bring her some black thread to patch some things for the boy. I should have known, just from her wanting black thread, that was a sign. Sure was. Just like Emma, remember? She kept asking for thread. Dropped dead that very evening. Yeah. Well, she was determined to have it. Kept on reminding me. I told her I had some to home, but no, she wanted it new. So I sent little June to get some that very morning when she was laying dead. I was just fixing to bring it over, along with a piece of sweetbread. You know how she craved my sweetbread. Sure did. Always bragged on it. She was a good friend to you. I believe it. Well, I had no more got my clothes on when Sally bust in the door hollering about how Charlie here had been over to Miss Alice, saying she was dead. You could have knocked me over, I tell you. Guess Essie feels mighty bad. Oh, Lord, yes. But I told her, the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Wasn't her fault none. She makes good peach pies. But she bound to believe it was a pie did it. And I spec she right. Well, she shouldn't worry herself none about that. She was just doing what we all would have done. Yeah, 'cause I was sure wrapping up that sweetbread. And that could have done it, too. I doubt that. Sweetbread is pure. But a pie is the worst thing to give anybody ailing. I'm surprised Jimmy didn't know better. If she did, she wouldn't let on. She would have tried to please. You know how she was. So good. I'll say. Did she leave anything? Not even a pocket handkerchief. The house belongs to some white folks in Clarksville. Oh, yeah? I thought she owned it. May have it one time, but not no more. I hear the insurance folks been down talking to her brother. How much do it come to? $85, I hear. That all? Can she get in the ground on that? Don't see how. When my daddy died last year this April, it costed $150. Of course, we had to have everything just so. Now, Jimmy's people may all have to chip in. That undertaker that lays out black folks ain't none too cheap. Seems a shame. She's been paying on that insurance all her life. Don't I know? Well, what about the boy? What's he gonna do? Well, can't nobody find that mama. So Jimmy's brother gonna take him back to his place. They say he got a nice place, inside toilet and everything. That's nice. He seems like a good Christian man. And the boy needs a man's hand. What time's the funeral? 2:00. She ought to be in the ground by 4. Where's the banquet? I heard Essie wanted it at her house. No, it's at Jimmy's. Her brother wanted it so. Well, it will be a big one. Everybody liked old Jimmy. Sure will miss her in the pew. The funeral banquet was a peal of joy after the thunderous beauty of the funeral. It was like a street tragedy with spontaneity tucked softly into the corners of a highly formal structure. The deceased was the tragic hero, the survivors the innocent victims. There was the omnipresence of the deity, strophe and antistrophe of the chorus of mourners led by the preacher. There was grief over the waste of life, the stunned wonder at the ways of God and the restoration of order in nature. at the graveyard. Thus, the banquet was the exaltation, the harmony, the acceptance of physical frailty, joy in the termination of misery, laughter, relief, a steep hunger for food. Charlie had not yet fully realized his aunt was dead. Everything was so interesting. Even at the graveyard, he felt nothing but curiosity. And when his turn had come to view the body at the church, he had put his hand out to touch the corpse to see if it were really ice cold, like everybody said. But he drew his hand back quickly. Aunt Jimmy looked so private, and it seemed wrong, somehow, to disturb that privacy. He had trudged back to his pew, dry-eyed, amid tearful shrieks and shouts of others, wondering if he should try to cry. Back in his house, he was free to join in the gaiety, enjoy what he really felt, a kind of carnival spirit. He ate greedily and felt good enough to try to get to know his cousins. There was some question, according to the adults, as to whether they were his real cousins or not, since Jimmy's brother, O.V., was only a half-brother, and Charlie's mother had been the daughter of Jimmy's sister, but that sister was from the second marriage of Jimmy's father, and O.V. was from the first marriage. One of these cousins interested Charlie in particular. He was about 15 or 16 years old. Charlie went outside and found the boy standing with some others near the tub where Aunt Jimmy used to boil her clothes. He ventured a tentative, "Hey." They responded with another. The 15-year-old named Jake offered Charlie a rolled-up cigarette. Charlie took it, but when he held the cigarette at arm's length and stuck the tip of it into the match flame instead of putting it in his mouth and drawing on it, they laughed at him. Shamefaced, he threw the cigarette down. He felt it important to do something to reinstate himself with Jake. So when he asked Charlie if he knew any girls, Charlie said, "Sure." All the girls Charlie knew were at the banquet, and he pointed to a cluster of them, standing, hanging, draping on the back porch. Darlene, too. Charlie hoped Jake wouldn't pick her. "Let's get some and walk around," said Jake. The two boys sauntered over to the porch. Charlie didn't know how to begin. Jake wrapped his legs around the rickety porch rail and just sat there staring off into space as though he had no interest in them at all. He was letting them look him over and guardedly evaluating them in return. The girls pretended they didn't see the boys and kept on chattering. Soon their talk got sharp. The gentle teasing they had been engaged in with each other changed to bitchiness, a serious kind of making fun. That was Jake's clue. The girls were reacting to him. They had gotten a whiff of his manhood and were shivering for a place in his attention. Jake left the porch rail and walked right up to a girl named Suki, the one who had been most bitter in her making fun. "Want to show me around?" He didn't even smile. Charlie held his breath, waiting for Suki to shut Jake up. She was good at that, and well known for her sharp tongue. To his enormous surprise, she readily agreed and even lowered her lashes. Taking courage, Charlie turned to Darlene and said, "Come on along. We're just going down to the gully." He waited for her to screw up her face and say no, or what for, or some such thing. His feelings about her were mostly fear that she would not like him, and fear that she would.